Welcome to Thrivers, impact-driven leadership for the next normal. I am your host, Tucker Wanamaker, the CEO of Thrive Impact. And if you're listening to this, you are probably someone who doesn't just want to do nice things in the world, but you actually want to create positive change in people's lives and not burn out while doing it. Well, how do you do that? Well, that's our mission, is really to redefine what normal is for workplace leadership, to be about co-creating impact from the inside out. We believe and know that burnout is the enemy of creating positive change. And we want to connect you with impact-driven leaders and ideas so that you can learn to thrive in today's landscape. I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, Sarah Fanslow, our Chief of Impact. Sarah, it is so nice to be here with you today.
It's good to be here.
I'm appreciating your new microphone, by the way. Thanks for, I know, you're upgrading your system.
Fancy. Yeah.
Well, and today we have a guest that I have been looking forward to having on this podcast. He is an individual that we have been working with for quite some time. But let me just go ahead and introduce him real quick. He is the president and CEO of the Rochester Area Community Foundation. His name is Simeon Bannister. And Simeon, before I invite you to share a little bit about yourself and the Community Foundation, one thing, I just want to appreciate who you are as a leader. And I know we've had some coaching times before, and we've done a lot of work together as organizations. And the way that you so thoughtfully lean into vulnerability as yourself, and the way that you are sharing where you're learning and share where you've made mistakes, just the way that you have leaned in so you just go for it. You've leaned into that space. I never feel like there's any kind of like protection of oneself. You just are leaning into this being, you know, this learning and vulnerability. And it has just been really inspiring for me to watch as somebody who has stepped into this role a little over a year ago. And so Simeon mm-hmm. Bannister, Simeon, it's great to have you on this podcast and be interviewing you today.
Well, I am so grateful to be here. And I think that description is an apt one. We can't learn if we don't lean in. And I want to thank you guys for really working with us to kind of cultivate that kind of environment and to build the kind of trust, because that's certainly a prerequisite for that kind of vulnerability. And it's making a big difference. And I'm glad to be here to talk to you guys about it.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Simeon, you know, I think our sort of organizing question for this podcast today is really speaking to community foundation CEOs. And there are a lot of community foundations that are out there in the country. And, you know, it's interesting as we've been shifting our work at Thrive Impact, where it's not just about nonprofits and foundations, it's about being impact-driven leaders. And that's one thing that I've appreciated again about you is that you're looking at the work and saying, no, we really need to create positive change and know that we're creating positive change, not just in our community, but also within ourselves. And so I'm using this distinction of how do impact-driven community foundation CEOs, which is of course a juxtaposition to, there are probably some community foundation CEOs who are frankly not impact-driven. Like they maybe not want to measure their impact. And they're a little bit more about potentially egos or just staying comfortable, maybe just to keep it a little bit nicer, but really focusing in on this impact-driven nature of leadership right now. How do impact-driven community foundation CEOs make steps to build learning organizations and to lead in this next normal? I mean, that's really our organizing question for this particular interview today, because you've been going through a lot and you've stepped into this role of a relatively well-run organization and we're noticing that there is some shifts that the world was forcing upon us, that, you know, including COVID and beyond, that you were noticing that, we need to make some shifts in our organization. So I wanted to unpack that question a little bit, particularly starting with your first year as a CEO, because you've been CEO since October of 2022. Is that correct? I believe
that's right. That's right. Yeah.
And like, kind of want to unpack just a little bit, like what you came into it with. What were some of your hopes? What were some of your sorrows as you went through this first year of being a CEO? And then what made you feel like, wow, we do need to make some shifts in our organization?
Yeah. So to me, the point of departure for philanthropy is really in the word. It's the love of humanity. Mm. And fundamentally, to lead with love, to be driven to make life better for folks that are in the community that I grew up, was really the kind of North Star for so much of our work. And I have to take an aside and point out that I use the reference to the North Star intentionally. This is the city of Frederick Douglass, the North Star paper. And so there's a huge legacy, frankly, that we have in this community to live up to. And so in that regard, you know, coming into the Community Foundation, I'd been here for a while. I kind of started as a program officer, working on what we described as our equity portfolio. Rochester Area Community Foundation is pretty cool because even before I got here, we were explicitly naming equity as a key foci for our work. And that was not common. So these days, it's more common to hear folks describe equity and to focus on, you know, kind of some of the historic challenges that communities have faced and how we need to redress those challenges. But that wasn't common back in 2010 when RACF said that that's really where we wanted to focus our energy. And I have to give a big nod of the tip of the cap to my predecessor for having the courage to step out and to take it on. The world is a really dynamic place.
Yeah.
Things are changing constantly. And as I came into the community foundation movement, and specifically our community foundation, I realized that I brought a different set of experiences to the foundation. If I can tell you just a little bit about myself, I'm born and raised here in Rochester. And Rochester, like many cities, has its own kind of cultural mores and kind of ingrained behaviors and patterns. And a lot of times in a lot of cities, those tend to be geographically focused. So, right, like certain neighborhoods get down with other neighborhoods. And so here in Rochester, it's kind of east side, west side. It's kind of like a big part of what it means to be. And if you're from Rochester, you know what that means. If you're an east sider, particularly from the part of Rochester that is the African-American community, you kind of know what it means to be from the east side or to be from the west side. So I had this really unique experience because I grew up living on the east side. That's where I laid my head at night. But Rochester, my dad and my family really lived on the west side. My dad was kind of a west side guy. And so I ended up with this kind of interstitial experience, kind of crossing back and forth and in between east side and west side. Rochester is also a city that deals with very thick segregation from an economic perspective. And that also, by the way, of course, registers in terms of race. So you know, folks that are doing well, generally in the suburbs, folks that are not doing well, generally in the city. Again, in this experience that I had growing up, we could traverse these boundaries, right? Sometimes in the city, sometimes in the burbs. My dad was a manager for Xerox. My mom was an educator. And what that all left for me was this ability to cross some of the boundaries that were typically things that kept us separated and apart in Rochester. And so coming to the foundation, that was my experience that I brought to this building, was kind of a deeper understanding, I think, of what was happening on the ground, being from Rochester, but an ability to articulate some of those challenges in places where that was not usual and uncommon to hear that voice. And that's really been a robust. So that was a lot of my aspirations, was to do that work more effectively. We thought about the kind of the nature of the foundation, an endowment-focused organization. Okay, that big old endowment, what are you going to do with it, right? We decided that we wanted to use it because there were some obligations that we had, and some of those obligations included being the community's translator.
Well, and as you really became, you know, the president and CEO, I'm curious, what were your original hopes? And then as you went through your first year, what were some of your... I mean, maybe sorrows is strong, but I'm curious, you know, what were the hopes that you originally stepped into it with, and then some of the sorrows or maybe even the shifts that you made as you're like, oh, this is what I'm dealing with. Oh, this is me being a president and CEO. Both the individual, you know, hopes and sorrows, and also maybe the organizational ones.
All right. So, you know, I had been here at the foundation for like 5 years before becoming CEO. So, you know, one of the things, I'm sure this is true for a lot of folks stepping into new roles, you kind of figure like, man, I got a head start because I already know everybody, right? And they already know me. And yeah. So, which was great. I mean, so I could kind of hit the ground running and came in with a lot of big aspirations, again, a really idiosyncratic view of how we could leverage that endowment to start to create even more impact in the community, how we could use this position as a trusted voice in the community to, you know, bring more people together, how we could start to build our infrastructure internally, particularly around data and analysis, mm-hmm. so that we could deliver more value to our community and kind of more perspective. So I expected, man, like, let's go. And I'm the kind of guy that kind of likes to move quickly. You know, I was eager to kind of get this up and running, as you guys know, and to get this thing cracking. And so I had, you know, kind of in my mind, you know, all right, here's what we're doing at a month. Here's what we're doing at 3 months. Here's what we're doing at 6 months. Here's what we're doing at a year. And we were just going to flow and flow and flow and go and go and go. And of course, reality puts a check on that. And so I recall one of the first meetings I had as CEO. We had done some things because we were coming out of the pandemic. We hadn't been together in space in a while. And so we did some activities, which were actually a lot of fun. And folks were you know, really excited. And there was a lot of exuberance. And so I was like, all right, we're all exuberant together. Let's get cracking, you know? And folks said, whoa, 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 buddy. You know, we're excited, but we still need to pace ourselves. And so I'll tell you the story where that happened. We had just launched Microsoft 365 here, and Teams and all these different tools. And, you know, I'm a widget kind of guy. So I was super excited about like how this was going to improve our communications and, you know.
Yeah.
And so I went to a meeting that we were having, a staff meeting, to tell everybody about 365 and how we were going to use it. And the first response was, why like email? So why do I have to switch? And I was like, well, but you don't actually have to, you know, you have to do something different. It's a complementary tool. And they were like, yeah, but I'm not buying that. I just like what I'm doing is working. You know? And I was like, yeah, no, but it's better and it'll make us more efficient and it's all the bells and whistles. And you know, sometimes the inclination in a moment like that is to just try to, let me just throw my shoulder into it harder. You know, let me just try to push it even faster. And if I can just get people to see it, then we'll be in good shape. And that was not what needed to happen there. Hmm. At the same time as I was going through that experience, I had started talking with you guys, with you, Tucker and Sarah, and was learning about some of that pacing, and particularly this idea of how important it was to create a sense of belonging and psychological safety. And what I realized is that even with these technology tools, right, even all that enthusiasm and excitement, if we had skipped over perhaps some of those steps around creating psychological safety, that it was like, look, I got something that works and I'm holding on to that. My email situation, I got it structured the way that I like it, and that's all good. And I like it and it does what I want it to do and it works. And I was saying, well, does it work? How do we know it works? Do we want to test that? Do we want to probe that? And that was introducing for folks a sense of the unknown. And what I think we've started to learn here was that we do have to do that. That's important. We've got to explore the unknown. We've got to embrace curiosity. But as a prerequisite to that, we've really got to think through how we set the culture so that the room is there for trial and error. And I've learned a lot from you guys about that.
Well, I'm curious, Simeon, on that piece. You know, you have a relatively large number of staff, I think close to 40, is that right? Something like that?
A little over now, yeah.
Over 40 now. So I'm curious about, you know, what are some ways that you have built that psychological safety? And then to put that question back on you, how do you know you built it, right? Like, what are the ways that you're measuring that within your own organization? I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I'm so glad that you asked that question, particularly around this idea of measurement, because it is so critical and so important. And it's another space for innovation and another space for curiosity, because there's some elements that are very easy to kind of put your finger on. And, you know, we've tried to do some survey work and that kind of thing, which has been really helpful. But some of it, I wouldn't describe it necessarily as just kind of like visceral or gut instinct, but some of it is being observant and in some sense in your own head, kind of quantifying the experiences that you're having with folks as you're watching them start to come out of, you know, some of the kind of psychological crevices that we all build for ourselves to try to hide out when we feel like change is afoot. And so just in terms of some of the tactical things that, frankly, we learned from you guys that really helped us to make some progress. Number one was embracing a spirit of appreciative inquiry. You know, here we asked a lot of times questions that we would ask would kind of have a little bit of extra meaning to them. Say it that way, hopefully diplomatically. and frankly, there was at times a little bit of the kind of gotcha sensibility, you know, and that's really challenging to encourage folks to, you know, try new things if they feel like, well, if I make a mistake, someone's standing there ready to get me, you know? And frankly, in some cases, that wasn't really a malicious part of the culture. Interestingly, it wasn't like, you know, we were just sitting here sharpening knives, ready to take everybody down, but it had become part of this perception of the need for perfection. Right. That as an organization like ours, we got to be perfect. We've got to, you know, cross every T. We've got to dot every I because that's what the donors expect from us.
Right.
They expect perfection. But funny enough, in a lot of ways, we hadn't really tested whether that was even the expectation. Right? Like we presumed that it was the expectation that if we did anything wrong, everyone would take their money out and run away from the foundation. Right. When in fact, I think what we've come to learn over this year is that people actually really appreciate when we try new things. They appreciate our innovation. They appreciate when they're coming to our events and they feel more authentic and not perfect, but real, you know? And so if I would say anything to folks that are listening as CEOs, you know, we sometimes dance on this knife's edge of trying to make sure that, you know, everything is, you know, together. And that's what we even try to articulate to our boards. You know, it's kind of like that meme where the fire is going and there's the little dog and he's like, there's nothing to see here. It's all good. It's all good. It's like, I need some water, you know? And even when it's not necessarily a fire, you know, there's still room to say like, we're learning and we're growing together. And that's been really critical for our team. I'll tell you one other just quick story that was really helpful. I'm the kind of guy when I was a kid, I had a job and one of my first jobs. And I remember saying to my mom that I didn't like the job. I said, Ma, you know, this job, you know, it's not fun. And I don't really like it. And my mom said to me, as, you know, a mother would do, you know, trying to equip her child to go out into this world of work. She said, Simeon, jobs aren't about liking, jobs are about working and work works.
Yeah.
And so and that was really the work works, you know, so that defined my career for, you know, the first, you know, a good chunk of it was just running through walls, working, you know, doesn't matter how it feels, doesn't matter whether you like it or not. You just got to get the job done. And a couple of years back, I realized that that wasn't, it was good advice actually for a young person starting out, you know, and that kind of thing. But maybe that advice was missing a dimension of the humanity that we need to be able to bring to our work. And so, you know, one of the things that we've really tried to embrace, is more of that humanity. So I said to our team, I said, you know, guys, you know, instead of staff meeting, I said, I want everybody to, you know, be clear. We got to take vacation, you know, take your time to recharge. And that's important. So I said that, and then a couple of meetings later, I had noticed that people weren't really, you know, doing that. And so I said to everybody again, you know, we got to do our work and, you know, and I kind of casually mentioned, I wasn't really making a point with this, but I mentioned that I was going to be going on vacation, you know, the next week to go and do my thing or whatever. And a bunch of people came up to me after the meeting and they were like, listen, when you were saying go on vacation, that didn't really mean that much. But when we saw you do it yourself, that was really what we needed in our culture. We needed you to model that, to show your own willingness to take a break and to catch yourself. And that's really become definitional for a lot of my leadership is trying to be as honest and authentic as possible so that people feel like they can do the same. And in so doing, it's unlocked a whole range of possibilities for us.
Yeah, you can't just say you're going to do it differently. You have to do it differently and let people watch.
That's exactly right. Otherwise, they don't believe you. You know, it's like because we live in a culture where, you know, there is so much you know, deviation between what people say and what they do, you know? And so as they say, you know, the old aphorism, actions speak louder than words.
That's right.
Well, in this making of this shift that you've been going through and that your organization's going through, I want to speak a little bit into that experience that we all had where we brought the whole organization together. It was the first time, I think it was ever, that the whole board and the whole staff was all in one big room together in however long, you know, the Community Foundation's been around for many, many years, many decades. And to your point of not wanting it more perfect, people want it more real. Tell me about what that experience was like, because that takes courage. I mean, that takes, that takes some, which courage means that there's vulnerability. It's like, we've never done this before. What if, what are they going to think about it? And you know, one of the things that your whole, especially your main leadership team, brought forward were, some reflections on the previous year of 2023 and around sorrows, shifts, and celebrations. There were things that they were sorrows and disappointments around just in and of themselves, right? The shifts that they made around where they realized they'd learned something. And because of that learning, they made a shift accordingly. And then things that they did want to celebrate. But I remember the, you know, the feeling of some of that. And I mean, it was close. You know, I was like, it's like everybody's nervous system was a little bit going in overdrive, you know? And so I just want to, I want to hear your side of that story of like, what did you notice, like how you needed to lean into this more real approach? How did you do that and ultimately help the staff to get to that place to where they shared some of these with the whole board, which was unheard of before?
Yeah. So this organization is now 52 years old. And in some sense, I saw a little quote the other day that said that old is the new, right? and so we were, you know, when we were really, really small, I imagine that there were times when, you know, we've got two people that were working at the foundation and we were just getting started. Everybody was in the same room together because they had to be, because there was nobody, no place else to go. But certainly as we've grown, and we're a foundation that grew really fast. And so what's interesting is that you have some vestiges from the culture as it evolves that were not necessarily attended to, that we needed to really kind of focus on, and that some of the culture questions. Also, just thinking through continuity was a big question for us. So, you know, it's really easy for organizations. You got your mission and your vision. You've got, you know, your strategic plan or whatever, you know, tool you use, which are usually, in my experience, more like goal setting than it is true strategy. And then you've got, you know, your budget, and you've got some form of perhaps a work plan. And then, of course, the dreaded performance evaluation, right? and as organizations, for many of us, those things operate almost autonomously from one another, that you can't really see the line from the mission and the vision all the way through, particularly to the performance evaluation question. And maybe performance evaluation might not even be the right language that we want to use for that moment. And so, you know, for us, as an organization, what we realized was that there was an opportunity for us to kind of jump in here to get everybody together back in the same room, just like perhaps even way back in the old days here, but now with a lot more people in the room and a lot more perspective. And it did take an act of courage, because what we were asking folks to do was to come into the room and, hey, be vulnerable, right? Don't come into the room so that we can, you know, genuflect and, you know, describe how everything is going well. But to come into the room and to do some true strategic thinking, which is identifying where there were challenges, where there were barriers, what was going great, what things we needed to learn from and where we could grow. And that's not an exercise that that we typically do. And I want to be clear that, man, we had a great time doing it, but it was not perfect either, right? There were areas for confusion. There were opportunities for feedback. One of the things that I think was really, really critical for our experience was the tools that you guys were helping us to use, like the Easy Retro Board. You know, I thought it was really a critical element. Hopefully listeners are familiar with these kinds of tools, but it was a way for people in the room who are not kind of verbal processors. I'm a verbal processor, you know, I'm in the room and someone asks me a question, I'm ready to go, you know, but other folks tend to be more pensive or may not feel as comfortable expressing themselves verbally, even if they've already had some of the thinking. And so these tools were great because they gave nonverbal processors a chance to engage and participate mm-hmm. and ask questions in a lower stakes kind of way, which is really critical to get that feedback. And so that experience for us gave us a chance to advance some new ideas, to start down this road of innovation, to get really good feedback, and most importantly, to have a co-creative experience. And that was really, I think for us, just such a beautiful moment. And I will tell you, like, when I say beautiful, I don't mean that just to be kind of like, you know, cheesy here. I was at a meeting, man, and we were talking about this and kind of after that, that huge opportunity for us to bring everybody together in a subsequent meeting. And all of a sudden you started to hear these seeds that were dropped at the, at the big meeting. Begin to poke up, just like when you've got new plants that you've planted and those seeds are starting to poke through the dirt. And I could hear new formulations, different departments talking with each other in ways that they hadn't before, different colleagues engaging in ways. And I will tell you, I've been going through some challenge and stuff. My unfortunately, I just lost my mom recently. And I was in this meeting and I was telling everybody about, you know, how excited I was to see this new innovation, these new opportunities. And at the same time, earlier that week, my mom and I had spent the night in the emergency room, which had been a really harrowing experience of seeing human suffering in a way that, you know, you just don't see every day. And I was saying to our team why all this innovation was important, that it wasn't just like, you know, its intrinsic value of innovation and feeling good, but that it was really about how we get the best of ourselves to address, in this case, the human suffering. And I will tell you, like, tears, you know, were welling up in my eyes. And it was like, you know, and you guys know me in this way, maybe listeners don't. I don't tend to be a particularly like outwardly emotional, you know, kind of guy, but man, that day, I mean, it was like raw, you know?
Wow.
These moments are so critical though for us, because a lot of times we think of our organizational progress only in terms of the kind of like structured changes that we're making and the, you know, kind of, you know, only the quantifiable data. I want to be clear, that data is critical, really, really important. But guess what? Culture is too. And in fact, in many ways, culture is what enables that data to be useful for us.
Yes.
And so we're just super excited about the work that we've been able to do with Thrive to start to unlock our culture and the way that that's registering for us. Plus, you know, again, you know, I remember the first time that Tucker, you familiarized me with this idea of this kind of complex changing world around us and how that complexity would and the limitations on human adaptability would require us to do things differently. And man, that has made a huge difference for the way that I'm thinking about our work.
Well, and I have to give some just props to you and your team sitting in some of these meetings, taking, you know, the innovations down into work plans, and in particular, some of your senior leaders. Honestly, I've just been bowled away by, you know, a staff member might say to them, well, I'm not sure about that goal. I'm nervous about being able to meet that. That feels like a stretch. And your leaders are saying, but what if we try? And like, what if, you know, it's okay if we don't meet it, you know, and just some of that willingness to learn and to try and to swing for the fences and say, we're swinging right now, right? And we may get it over the fence and we may fall a little short, and either way, that's okay, right? As long as we're learning together. And so I just want to, I've been in these meetings and I thought, man, you know, there's some awesome leaders y'all have, including yourself, but these senior leaders who are standing up and saying, let's do new things and swing for the fences while we're doing it.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's like the most gratifying things to come to work with colleagues that have that same sensibility, that are eager to try new things. And I'll tell you, the thing that's been even more exciting is watching some of my colleagues who before didn't feel that sense of, you know, kind of openness and that sense of curiosity, that sense of, you know, willingness to try and see what happens, start to embrace it. And at the same time, I also want to be clear, and this is one of the things I loved about working with you guys at Thrive. It's also not cavalier, right? It's also not like, hey, let's just see what happens and we'll just see what happens, right? It's not unintentional. It's not, you know, we're having the opportunity to be really planful and really intentional about how we cultivate the space.
Yes.
And so before we got to that big meeting, we had sessions with our staff, we had sessions with the board that were kind of preparatory, so that by the time we got to the meeting that brought everybody in the room together, we had already deposited some of the skills that were going to be necessary to make that an effective session. And so I think that that's just really critical, because a lot of times, you know, we could have bowled our way into, you know, let's start with a new strategic plan. But if we hadn't developed some of those preliminary skills, it would not have been useful for us. And so I'm really grateful for the curated process. I believe you guys, we use the term choreographed process. It allows us, you know, and choreography is funny because, you know, some might say, oh, does that feel inauthentic? But, you know, the thing about choreography is all it does is it gives you the structure. You know, if anybody's ever tangoed before, you know, you still got to move your body and do your thing, but in that structure. And that's been really helpful for us.
Sammy, what I'm curious around what's made possible. You've already spoken to that a little bit around, you know, that that beautiful story that you just shared, literally using the word beautiful, of noticing this deep space that you've been in with your mom's passing, and noticing how that ties in actually with the importance of your work and all of your work. You know, but when you talked about your first year as a CEO, you were like coming in, right? You had this urgency and like, let's move. And I've noticed you having been slowing down, and you've used the phrase over this next year, as I think your fiscal year is coming up here in, in April. And you're like, over this next year for us, we need to learn how to learn together.
That's right.
And I noticed you're slowing down and giving breathing room. And you even spoke to it a little bit around, oh, we need to give people skills. Like, this is a whole different operating system for how people are able to live into this new world that we're in because of the speed of change and kind of what you mentioned before. And I'm curious, what helped you to slow down? Maybe I'm curious, very individually helped you to slow down. And then what's made possible by creating the space for you to slow down? I'm also curious, what are some of the tensions around slowing down? Because you're like, we still got a budget process and we still got to do things that we got to do. You know, you're like, oh, absolutely. And there's this interesting tension here. But what caused you to slow down in the first place to realize, wow, we really need to slow down to learn how to learn together, which is a beautiful statement. And then, what's coming from that? So curious about that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's part of Sarah's now, I think, first I was going to say world famous, but I think now it actually is universally, like across the universe, you know, and other planets are saying this, and, you know, the aliens are saying it, you know, when they come to visit, right? I believe a radio signal just came back to the planet saying, our no's allow us to say deeper yeses. And I will tell you that that's really been a big part of the thing that's been animating us this year is that, you know, it's really easy because, again, in your enthusiasm and excitement, there's a risk of becoming tone deaf and not hearing what people are actually saying to you. And I was really blessed that, you know, folks in my life, leaders that I had admired, who had really emphasized with me how important it was to listen to the people around you, and that a big part of leadership really was listening. So fortunately, we were doing these kind of, you know, internal listening sessions, meeting with colleagues, meeting with staff. And this refrain I kept hearing over and over again, that people felt overwhelmed. And at first I was like, all right, you know, come on, you know, we got work to do. All right, I hear you, but let's get to it, you know. But then I kept hearing it, and I heard it again and over. And when it landed with me, it really became clear that we had bitten off more than we can chew. And I actually think that that's the big problem of philanthropy, in particular community foundations. You see, we have this double-edged sword of being really flexible instruments. We can do a lot of different things, and we can solve a lot of different problems. And so then it's super easy to kind of get down these, you know, different roads. And I learned, you know, that it's not maybe as useful to do a lot of things simultaneously as it is maybe to do more things sequentially, right? And so we were trying to do a whole lot all at the same time, and it was asking too much of our colleagues. And at the same time, we didn't really have the tools. And I think this is one of the reasons why this becomes very challenging for us as community foundations. because again, we're flexible, we can do a lot of things. And if we're not really clear about our values and what we're trying to accomplish, then you don't have the basis to say no, right? Yes. Because how do you say no between making sure, it's all yeses, man. It's like, how are you going to say no between making sure that you've got, you know, good after school programming for young people, and you're making sure that seniors have places that are comfortable for them to age in place. Yeah. And you're making sure that your education system is well structured, and you're making sure that healthcare is being provided in an equitable way. And you're making sure that the relationships for civic infrastructure in your community are robust and grow. And you're making, right, all of a sudden it's like you've got this menu of options. And if you're not clear about what the threshing floor is to make some of those decisions, you end up doing all of them pretty poorly, you know. I want to add to that, you know, I mentioned earlier kind of this graphic that Tucker shared with us that showed increasing levels of complexity and kind of linear human adaptability. There's a great piece. There's a real kind of great thinker, Lucy Bernholtz, in our field, who has annually written these blueprints and really trying to kind of articulate what the future holds, almost like a futurist sensibility. And she has a chapter in her most recent blueprint titled Making Sense and Uncertainty. And she goes through and really describes how, you know, the infrastructure that we've come to rely on in a lot of ways has become outmoded in our communities from a societal perspective, right? And so now there's this big shift where if people aren't trusting the private sector in the ways that they used to, they aren't trusting the government, public sectors in the way that they used to, then who steps into that role, right? In a lot of ways, community foundations are being asked to take on all kinds of new roles and responsibilities that diverge from what we've done in the past. And they represent innovative opportunities for sure. But to engage them, ironically, we actually do need to slow down and make clear choices and to try to, as best as we can, to appreciate the implications of those choices. But in a complex world, you can't anticipate everything. You just can't. It's just not possible, right? It's just too dynamic. And so, you know, far be it from me, who, you know, I read as much as I can, try to learn as much as I can, and have a fraction of an answer for any one thing. At best, you know, that model is limited. At worst, it can actually do damage where I'm responsible for making all the decisions and telling everybody what to do and being the CEO and that kind of stuff. And so it's so much more healthy for us. And frankly, like, lets me sleep a lot better at night to engage with lots more people to try to convene the discourse so that we are more generative and that we allow for resonance to emerge, where you start to hear the same kinds of questions, people thinking the same kinds of ways, and those become interesting areas for us to explore more deeply. And that's this kind of cadence of learning that we're trying to embrace. And it's been so far, you know, these last few months, it's been a lot of fun, if nothing else. And we think that we're our work, the quality of our work is getting a lot better too.
I was just going to say, I think you do have you are in a particularly challenging spot as community foundations because you have a lot of resources, right? And you're not always the one. I know you all do some kind of direct work, but for the most part, you're working through and with other people to make community change, right? Which means that measurement of success and the what are we ultimately working towards, it's hard. It's even harder. And so that piece around do no harm, I think, is so important, not just for physicians, but anybody working in the toward the public good, because we can say we're trying to do a lot, but unless we say intentionally, we're really, you know, going deep and understanding that, especially in your case, a lot of the things you're working toward is long-term change. You're not going to see short, you know, and this is where it gets hard for folks because, you know, people want to see immediate change, and that's not how intractable issues work. And so I just want to appreciate that you all are in a particularly challenging spot, I think, in terms of being able to do work that is showing folks change while knowing that some of the tails are really long.
Yeah, it's tricky too, because there's often in our communities, we're certainly in this position, I know many community foundations are, where we're the largest, you know, kind of community philanthropic organizations in the areas that we serve. We're the largest, you know, philanthropic organization in our region, and that's true for many of my counterparts. And so think about it this way, you know, there's often a misperception. So people hear, you know, in our case, we're a $600 million foundation, right? And people hear $600 million. Right. Well, you ought to be able to write a check and solve everything, you know?
That's right.
Not appreciating that it is a drop in the bucket for the kinds of challenges that we're trying to confront. And that's actually, frankly, true for the nonprofit sector. There's a interesting piece called Uncharitable, a film that just came out, came out a little while ago, actually. This guy, Dan Pallotta, asked some really interesting questions around the unrealistic expectations that society has placed on our part of the civic infrastructure to solve really, really big challenges with, you know, resources that are limited relative to those challenges.
Right.
And some of the expectations that have been set about nonprofits and how they should function. And I tend to agree with a lot of the thinking in that particular film, not all of it actually, but with a lot of it, that we actually are often limited in the approaches that we can take, the strategies that we can deploy, yet we've got a big appetite for change because we can all see the suffering that results from the lack of it, and we can all see, even more importantly, the opportunity. Man, what could we be?
It's right
who
there.
Could we be?
Right.
It feels like it's right there, you know?
Yeah.
So for us, the way that we resolve some of that tension is through what we describe as catalytic community impact, a realization that we are not ourselves going to solve any, or, you know, certainly not every, perhaps even any challenge by ourselves, but that we can be a catalyst. We can be the stone in the pot.
Right.
And that's what we often seek to do.
And Simeon, you've hit on a little bit of what's made possible, but I wanted to speak just explicitly to that. What's made possible when you are able to let your no's give power to your most important yeses? What's made possible when you're able to slow down and sequence things versus just by default? If we don't sequence, then by default, it's all just now, right? It's all, it's like everything's urgent. And you spoke to what's made possible a little bit for you as an individual CEO. And I know that that's been a big piece of your journey. But I'm curious what's made possible for you as a CEO. Yeah. Like, as you said, I'm able to sleep better at night, but I want to unpack that a little bit more of what you've been able to let go of and what's been made possible for you as a human being who is a CEO of an organization, and ultimately what's made possible for the organization itself if you're able to lean into these types of approaches.
Yeah. All right. So there's levels to this thing, right? So, you know, we can speak certainly on an individual basis. I do, frankly, sleep better at night. I mean, one of the, a little bit of the angst that I had before I was in this role, I ran our community programs department, mostly responsible for the community leadership and the grant making of the community foundation. And frankly, at times it felt like picking winners and losers. I mean, just to be perfectly candid. And what's fascinating is that in the field right now, the pendulum has kind of swung to what folks have come to describe as trust-based philanthropy. I haven't frankly seen a really good definition of trust-based philanthropy, but what I often hear it described as is, you know, just give out the money and let it go. And I think that that is an abdication of the responsibility that we actually do have to be good partners, to create synergies, to connect folks, to give insights. Our job is not just to write a check and hope that it works out. I think our job is to bring value to that process. And so, you know, for us, in order to be able to deliver that kind of value, if we've spread ourselves too thin, we don't actually have the capacity to do that well.
Yeah.
And so the next level from an organizational level for us, we believe that by honing in and focusing, we actually have the chance to deliver more for the partners that we're working with. And what's pretty cool about that, too, is that in Rochester, and I think this is true in a lot of communities, but certainly it's true here, we actually have the capacity for a very complementary philanthropy. And so there are a number of, you know, private foundations, corporate foundations. There are other public foundations with whom we work. And because we are modeling what it means to have the discipline to focus, that's certainly an example for our counterparts. And so then what that means for us is, for example, our focus on kind of systemic challenges blends really nicely with another organization in our community that focuses on direct service provision, right? While they are making sure that the food cupboards are stocked and, you know, ready for emergency circumstances, we are there trying to make sure that food deserts are ameliorated and that systemically we have a more effective food system. And so from an organizational perspective, we get just a lot of benefits by honing in and focusing. And then frankly, from a regional kind of community and even societal perspective, if you can blend all of these together, right, with that kind of clarity, then we have a chance to really engage in mutually reinforcing activities. Yes. That's really the premise of collective impact as an example. And if we can create those mutually reinforcing activities because we are actually clear about where our values are and what we are delivering to our communities, then man, we can really start to make some meaningful headway on some of these big challenges.
I love that. So often we see in our work this idea of folks just not really knowing their place in the unique place in the ecosystem, which means then they don't know others' unique place, which means then they're not working together. And what I just heard you say is that's exactly what you all are doing. What's our place? What's yours? How can we both know that in support of our shared objectives?
Yeah. So Sarah, what that does then is it reduces competition, which frankly, I actually don't believe, you know, there are spaces for competition where it makes sense. Our space is not one of them, frankly.
Nope.
What we need is cooperation. And because that kind of cooperation maximizes our limited resources. And I just want to say a word about this because I think it's really critical to make a distinction between absolute scarcity and relative scarcity, right? So, you know, in the kind of absolute sense, you know, is there so much air, so much water to go around? I suppose that's the case. And we've got to be, you know, thoughtful about that. Certainly in climate change and other areas, that's an area that we're certainly focused. And at the same time, the questions of relational scarcity really show up, right? Where do we want to drive resources? And there's been a lot of, I think a lot of angst about our sector because the perception is that we are not efficient with resources, that money gets wasted in the nonprofit community. And in fact, I actually find that not only is there a lot of efficiency, but the opportunity is even greater by braiding our efforts more intentionally, right? That's where we can actually relieve people of the sense that like money's being wasted because there's five organizations all doing the same thing. No, there's actually, we're doing it with different populations. We're doing it in different ways. And if we're intentional about demonstrating the complementarity there, that makes us a better place to invest resources. And that's a much better sell for folks to engage our sector.
I love that. Simeon, I want, just in closing, I wanted to bring forward some practical steps that CEOs can take. And I'd like to do it, if we can, around sort of these concentric circles that we've been talking about. We talk about creating impact from the inside out. That's what I even led with at the very beginning. And, you know, inside out means starting with yourself and then going to your team and more, you know, so conscious leadership is starting with yourself.
That's right.
Having a co-creative process, which you've been speaking to, is in your team. And then creating these rhythms of learning as an organization across the org out into your community. So there's like the self, the team, the org, and the community.
That's right.
And I'm curious if you can speak to a practical step each CEO can take around each one of those categories, starting with yourself, because that's where you've had a lot of growth, is just within yourself. Is we want to lead well in the world. The first place we need to lead well is within ourselves. And then just go out from there of like, what are some practical steps that Community Foundation CEOs can take around each one of those circles?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say as the most practical step is take a deep breath. I mean, and, you know, that might sound, kind of a bit trite, but all jokes aside, it is really, really critical to think about not only self-care and not just self-care is like go take a vacation, but self-care is being conscious about where your emotional state is at any given moment. You know, we said earlier, old is the new new. There's so much ancient wisdom about the importance of breathing and how breathing does influence our psychological state. And I will tell you, I mean, early on in this year, as I was going through my own, you know, kind of challenges, as I mentioned, with my mom's health and just, you know, dealing with the stress and the challenges, it's so easy to come into a meeting or into a conversation. And you really just need that one moment where you are frustrated and you lash out, or you're frustrated and someone asks you a question and you shut them down, right? And the echo effect that can have is so dramatic. I mean, it can be like seriously, you can lose talent behind it. You can have real issues and challenges. And so the first practical step I want to encourage is that kind of sense of, you know, kind of self-check-in really throughout the day, making sure that you're just good, that you're coming into those interactions with intentionality. Hey, I want to make a distinction. That is not the same as having to be perfect all the time and having to, like, you know, deny your humanity and act like everything's good, even when it's not. It is having the emotional maturity to recognize when you are having those challenges, to wrestle with those challenges in yourself, and to equip yourself to then engage in constructive ways with the people around you. And sometimes, frankly, it is through vulnerability. It's saying, yeah, I'm having a rough day today because, and giving people a chance to understand. So that is what I would say there. Absolutely critical. I cannot overstate it. People say culture eats strategy for breakfast. It is true. Let me be a witness. Get that culture right. And so that's the second thing I would say from the organizational level is, as you are attending to your strategic plan and, you know, kind of goal setting and that kind of work, you want to be very, very thoughtful about the kind of culture that you're setting. How do you create, the way I think about it is, you know, before you drop seeds, you've got to till the ground, right? So how have you done that work to till the ground? Have you turned that soil over? Have you engaged with your people? Have you asked them questions? Have you built real meaningful relationships? Because the seeds that drop on that very fertile soil really have the chance to blossom and grow. But if you drop them on that hard, rocky, you know, never been tilled, iced over, no real relationships, then I can tell you that those seeds will lay fallow on the ground and you're probably going to be really frustrated. Mm-hmm. When those seeds do start to grow, I think it's all about confluence and continuity. Again, how does your mission and vision, how does that relate to your strategy? How does that relate to your work plan? That strategy, is it not just goal setting, but is it accounting for some of the challenges that you're trying to solve, and giving the room for creativity and innovation? And then, you know, you want to measure, check back in on a regular basis. And if you do that well, you become a model for other organizations mm-hmm. around the community. And frankly, you know, we think that the way I say it to you is this: Selma, Alabama, many people listening will know Selma, right? Because it's a place that, you know, important things happen. There are 17,000 people that live in Selma, Alabama. There are 200 and about 8,000 people that live in Rochester, New York. We think that if we do this right, we can be a model for social innovation for the nation. Mm. And that's the kind of aspiration that we have here at Rochester Area Community Foundation.
Love that. So breathe. Notice your own reactivity.
That's right.
Bring things back into your team. Build those relationships. And I know you did that in very practical ways. Like, you've used the word listening a lot.
Yes.
And listening is such is not just me hearing, but I know that you're also really good at reflecting back to people and helping them feel listened to.
That's right.
So I hear, like, listening is really that practical step.
Absolutely.
And then that can go not only within your team, but across the org and then ultimately in the community, is creating spaces of deep listening, reflecting back, that helps you to be that model of innovation.
Tucker, can I just, you know, just on that listening question. So it's also about how you create the requisite feedback loop. And so a lot of times we listen and we might even implement the things that we're listening, but then we don't circle back to our people to make sure that they knew that it was because of what you said that this thing happened.
Yes.
That is so, so, so critical. Because if we establish those feedback loops, then it gives people the sense that we're really credible. I'll give one example of that. Here, we did a little exercise. I encouraged one of my colleagues to come up to the front of the room, and I handed her a bag, and then I handed her another bag, and then I handed her a water bottle and the, you know, other things I could find around the room until she's standing in the room overloaded with stuff falling all out of her hands. And it was like ridiculous. And everybody was like, oh my gosh. And I said, does anybody in the room feel like this? And they said, yes, we feel like that. We feel like we're holding all these things. I said, we're going to work to try to get some of these bags put down, but that wasn't enough. Then we had to kind of start to do that activity. That wasn't enough. Then we had to start to go back to people and say, how did that feel? And then to give people the chance to share that out. And one of the things that's so exciting, I have watched my colleagues. There are a few folks that are here that, if I'm being honest, they had checked out. I mean, they had checked out because of just feeling so burnt out. Yeah. And to watch them re-enroll, to check back in, the new energy. There's one colleague in particular I'm thinking about, and I'm just enjoying the way she's showing up. I mean, just basking in it. And it's just been really a wonderful thing to see. And that gives me even more energy as a leader to do even more of it. Mm. And again, that gives us a chance to then be that seed that germinated and grows and affects the world around us.
So cycles of giving and receiving, right? They're self-reinforcing.
That's it.
Well, Simeon, thank you so much. Thank you for being a leader who's leaning in, who's who's creating catalytic community impact, that you're not just trying to be a donor advised fund service provider like some community foundations have found themselves, but you're really trying to do what the community foundation is here for, which is the community, and create that impact. But again, but doing it from the inside out, and how important that is to embody the very vision that you have for the world on the inside and actually living into it. And it's just really meaningful to watch you go through the shifts and go through the struggles that go along with that too. So thank you for just your presence, for your example in the world. And we're excited to continue on with more work.
Well, you guys are some great Sherpas, and you've been taking us, up the mountain, as it were. And so I have as much gratitude for you guys and the work that you've done with us to unlock some of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.